Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting live and on demand from Las Vegas, Nevada, where today is Memorial Day, May 29th, 2023. And I'm joined from Boston, where just the other morning I was leaving through the Buffalo Airport and I saw the Boston Celtics JetBlue airplane, branded Boston Celtics JetBlue airplane, on my way out. Joining me is Jesse Collins. Are the Boston Celtics still in the NBA playoffs?
Yes, not only are they still in the NBA playoffs, they are playing a Game 7 against the Miami Heat tonight, Monday night.
Tonight.
Which will run, of course, head-to-head with Monday Night Raw, which is probably not great for potential Raw rating on Monday morning, or coming out Tuesday.
Yes, this is so disorienting to think that this is a Monday and I'm doing the WrestleNomics podcast. Golo is in North Carolina, I think, exploring the state anyway, let's say. This is my first time ever being in the Pacific time zone. It is currently, I don't know, my computer is still on Eastern time, so it's 11 minus 3 in where I am officially. It's 7 o'clock. We're going to talk about Double or Nothing. We're going to talk about Saudi Arabia again for the ninth of, no wait, for the fifth? How many? There's 20 shows in the entire deal. For the ninth of 20 times, we will talk about WWE's relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And we'll talk about quite a bit about the AEW press conference, which I was there for. And even maybe some we will talk somewhat about Tony's comments and the media call that happened on Thursday before Double or Nothing. So, did you watch Double or Nothing on pay-per-view, Jesse?
I did. I ordered it on the venerable BR Live streaming app.
Okay. An official pay-per-view purchase.
Yes. It told me that I entered my CCV on my debit card incorrectly when I tried to order it, but then still somehow allowed me to order it anyway.
That sounds like Bleacher Report. Yep.
Yeah. So, but I didn't have any problems with streaming or buffering or anything like that. It was a nice clear stream for the entire duration of the show.
Okay. I watched it with my own eyes at various locations throughout the T-Mobile arena. I posted some pictures, one of the panoramic view. I wonder if people, we can probably, I have the slide here, right? I hope people think that I have like an amazing camera and an amazing, you know, photography skills. I don't. This is just the pano setting on my iPhone. So more about my iPhone later.
These purple structures that seem to be on both sides, yes, of the T-Mobile, yes, arena
on
television, when they would shoot like in the ring and you'd be able to see it like in the top corner of certain angles, they appear, yeah, to be like, you can't really make out the shape that well. They look like some gigantic luminescent purple house.
I don't know what they
somewhere
are.
Somewhere in the rafters. And it was very distracting and people were talking about it. Eventually someone live posted. You don't know what they are. Like, are they just design features? Are they, I was thinking they might be like special decks for like it could be like a cool bar.
These are suites that's what's on top of these things are suites. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's what's going on there.
You know, and this arena of course hosts a lot of, you know, big boxing matches. UFC runs here a lot, right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, so there's a lot of big money kind of events taking place. So
there's a UFC logo like permanently up in the right upper level there.
You did not get, it appears you did not get as good of a seat as Brian Alvarez, judging by this photo.
I heard they were in suites. They did, this now, is not Brian, where they
Chico,
the media.
Do you know where the green shirt guy for WWE pay-per-views is?
No.
The guy who wears a smiley face green shirt right in front row, directly opposite the hard cam at every single WWE pay-per-view.
I've heard something about there are certain fans who are at every WWE
pay-per-view. You seriously don't know this guy? He's been on your screen for hundreds of hours at this point. He wears a green t-shirt with a smiley face on it. Well, you don't know
who I'm
talking about?
He's no Vlad super fan. He's no ECW hat guy.
No, this guy's at every single show. Anyway, the point is that Chico was like right across from the hard cam in the front row. You could look at him the entire duration of the pay-per-view. And then you posted this photo and I said, they clearly didn't give Brandon as good of a seat as Brian Alvarez.
to be fair, the seat I was sitting in for this photograph, I was not ticketed for. I did buy, now let's be clear here, I did buy a resale ticket that I forget where it was. Didn't sit in the seat. They did comp media, as they always do. So they sat media where they always sit media, which is like directly opposite side of where the entranceway is. And just about in the center, just, you know, off a little bit. Yes.
But clearly by your ability to go up into the balcony and take this photo and a seat that you said you were not ticketed for would imply that there were available empty seats in this,
There are certainly available empty seats. Very, very strict security and ushers here at this building. First of all, they would not let me bring my backpack in, despite being credentialed media. Apparently, this is a T-Mobile thing. They are strict. This is a strict arena. But no, there were, as I posted on, you can see them on my Twitter. I don't have them in the slides, but they're definitely on the hard cam side, where the hard cam is. Lots of empty seats. Just huge. You know, mostly empty sections there, about two sections. Upper level was not full. Upper level on the hard cam side was draped. So, I mean, there's thousands of seats up there that just weren't open at all, that had a big black drape over them. Russell Tick's last count.
Oh, no, no. Keep going.
Real quick. So Russell Tick's last count, this is in the spreadsheet anyway, 10,550. That is not a final count, I assume. So I assume Russell Tix will have a final count maybe later. There were discounted tickets on Access, which is the official ticket vendor for T-Mobile Arena. You could, with a coupon code at least, you could get four tickets for $40. So there were discounted tickets happening here. I apologize for referencing on Friday or Thursday the burger and fries deal, which was fake. Comps, I don't know. If comps were especially, you know, bigger than usual. In any case, this is not a sellout. And I doubt it was $1 million gate. Tony did not say that it was.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the atmosphere for the show?
Oh, good question. So hot for the Battle Royal, which is the opener. Not very hot for everything in between that and the last two matches. The Statlander winning, beating Jade Cargill. Very hot. One of the biggest pops of the night when she won. You know, big pops for the big stuff, like when Wardlow jumped off and did the senton off the top of the ladder through the table mm-hmm. on the floor. Huge pop. But if you, Jesse, had gone up there and jumped off top of the ladder, but that would have got a huge pop too. And I heard that was the reaction for people watching it, was that the crowd did not seem very hot.
The crowd was very cold, like for basically what you described. The Battle Royal they were into, and then they actually seem to come to life a bit during the Taya versus Jade match. Like it started right when that match started, there was a dueling chance, and that was like the first time you really heard that. Kind of unexpected, but the crowd seemed to be into that more than a lot of the other stuff. Chris Jericho versus Adam Cole was just a completely dead crowd. No heat from the audience. Absolutely nothing during the match. Zero pop for Adam Cole winning.
Got booze, and I felt that was promotion heat for people not like that finish of the stoppage.
I know the match was bad, so I'm not surprised that the crowd like wasn't into it. But for stars of that caliber getting really no reaction, like I'm talking like you could hear a pin drop during this match. It was really surprising. I just, you know, even like, you know, when the announcer was like, and the winner, Adam Cole, like, I didn't even hear boos. I heard nothing. And you usually, even in a match that people don't care about, even for a wrestler people don't really care about, there would be like a level of polite clapping and maybe a little cheering when they announced the winner of the match. And that was not non-existent to my ears.
For cage match at this moment, we're recording at about just after 11 a.m. Eastern. 6.55 is the rating on Cage Match through 209 votes. That is substantially lower than a usual AEW pay-per-view. You have to go back to it's on the level of Revolution 2021, and it's just a little bit below that, and it's the lowest right now since All Out 2020, which has a 5.8.
Yeah, and you know, and for my book, it feels about right. I didn't think that this show was like a terrible wrestling show, but it was clearly below, I think, the expected average of AEW pay-per-views. And the crowd kind of reacted to that way. I don't know if you could pin that on. The build for the pay-per-view wasn't very good, so these matches didn't feel hot. Or just the execution wasn't there. Like, I think in Cole versus Jericho, I just think the execution was really bad. I thought the storyline for that match was fine leading up to it, but the performances from both guys, and I think especially Jericho, was like shockingly bad. And I think that really hurt the pay-per-view after a very fun battle royal that was kind of, you know, got the crowd going and had, you know, a very good, interesting finish that the crowd seemed to respond well to. And that kind of set the tone for most of the pay-per-view, really, until Statlander came out.
Yeah. Someone has made the point to me that, you know, the best AEW storylines are the ones that are happening off screen. So I think there's just a lack of emotional investment in a lot of the stuff that they're showing on the pay-per-view. Those last two matches were pretty hot. The stakes were high. I think the four-way build is not great, but people still treated the title match like it was a high-stakes title match. And the Anarchy in the Arena was nuts.
Yeah, and the thing about the four-way that really stood out to me in kind of like a negative way, nothing to do with the four-way itself, really, but when the four-way started and the guys went out and they just started, you know, doing big moves and wrestling at a crisp pace, it was like the first match on the show where I was like, this feels like an AEW match. This feels like an AEW show of guys going out there, doing big moves, working fast, crowds into, you know, what they're doing. Everything else on the show really was very plodding. Like the trios match that's supposed to be typically kind of a fun, fast-paced, almost Dragon Gate style six-man tag match was like this long limb work match where they isolated Anthony Bowens, and it wasn't fun. It wasn't like a terrible match. The execution of it was fine, but just the type of match it was not the right match for this kind of crowd in this kind of environment. Jericho versus Cole was very plodding. The tag team match was very much a shenanigans match. Although I thought that actually overachieved too. You had the ladder match, which I enjoyed, but was also kind of a plodding match where it's, you know, guys taking a long time to set up moves, as is most ladder matches are going to be, especially a singles ladder match. And so like by the time we got to the four-way, I was like, oh yeah, this is like a normal AEW match. This is what this promotion was built on. And I think that kind of fun, dynamic, fast-paced performances were largely lacking on the show, especially after you got after the Battle Royal ended. And I think it hurt the crowd, and I think it hurt people's interpretation of the pay-per-view.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of indicative of where AEW is right now, in that it's not as hot as once was, and whatever is happening on screen is, well, for one thing, not as interesting as what's happening off screen, at least to me. I don't know if fans more broadly or critical mass of fans are following the news behind AEW for that to matter a ton, but it's whatever's happening on screen is not connecting emotionally enough for this show to be hotter and for it to sell better too, at least in terms of ticket sales. We don't know what it did on pay-per-view. No one asked. I asked two questions in the press conference. I didn't ask, partly because I don't know that we're getting really reliable information in the last couple times we did get numbers in the press conference. So let's see. So did you listen to the media call on Thursday with Tony?
I didn't. I read a recap of it, but I can't say I've listened to the media call itself.
So the big news is coming out of the media call. Tony Khan, I asked him if Dynamite and Rampage have been renewed in, you know, coincidence with the addition of AEW Collision. And this is what he said on Thursday. The scope of the deal as it is, the length is the same. And I don't want to get too deep into those conversations, but I would say the length of the term is the same. And this is an addition to what we already put together. There was more talk along these lines last night at the press conference. I think Dave Meltzer asked him a question about Collision and the length. He said he's not supposed to get into it too much, but the time left is the same duration. I take this to mean that AEW's TV deal did not change in terms of length. So it's going to expire this year, December, or next year, December, if WBD picks up the option. I strongly suspect they will. But it's there certainly has not been a new deal put in place between AEW and WBD, which is what we expected by the time we recorded last week. No new deal. Additional show. And I did ask him on the presser last night, did you get more money for Collision? And in not so many words, he said, yes, there's additional revenue to go along with the additional show, because it's going to cost them tens of millions of dollars annually to put on an extra weekly show. Yes. So they're getting paid more. Don't know how much, but they're getting paid more. It's the same timeline deal, beginning January 2020, ending either December 2023 or December 2024. So a renewal between Warner Brothers Discovery and AEW has not taken place. They have modified their current deal.
Do you think that a Collision's existence has any relation to the Writers Guild of America strike?
No, I doubt it. I'd be surprised, because this is probably something. I mean, when did we start to hear murmurings of this happening? Well, or a better question might be, when was the trademark filed? I think that was like March-ish or something like that. And that's pretty far away from the WGA strike, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't following the WGA strike at the time. I assumed that there was a belief that they could potentially strike, you know, dating back quite a while.
Right.
So usually they don't just strike overnight.
WGA strike started on May 2nd, but who knows how long in advance it was, you know, expected to happen.
And again, I don't know how many properties on TBS and TNT are impacted by the writer's strike. As we know, they've really gotten away from scripted series and, you know, over the last few years. But part of me thinks that Collision did kind of come to it. While you did say, you know, they filed the trademark back in March.
I'm looking at the filing now. February 15, 2023 is when they first filed for AEW.
But it still kind of came together relatively quickly. And the fact that it's only seems to only have a contract for 18 months, if we believe what Tony said about the length of the deal not ending, would seem to imply it may be seen as almost a short, in some ways, a short-term solution to producing content during a time period where it might be difficult for the Warner Bros. Discovery umbrella altogether to produce content.
I'm not an expert on what other scripted programming is out there, but since Zaslav has taken over in WBD, they've cut a lot of scripted programming. The few scripted programs that they had left for those networks, at least some of them have gone away. I'm guessing they look at wrestling. And Tony did say on Thursday that it was David Zaslav's idea. David Zaslav literally came to them and said, we want to have more wrestling, two more hours on TNT.
He's the anti-Jamie Kellner.
We'll see about that. My impression is that they view wrestling as economical programming, that it's probably a lot cheaper for them to give AEW whatever incremental payment they're going to give them, tens of millions of dollars a year to cover the tens of millions of dollars a year in expense, maybe a little bit extra, versus doing another Snowpiercer or whatever. I don't know what the Snowfall. I don't know. You name the
Snowfall TNT is an FX show, but Snowpiercer was a TBS and TNT show. They're advertising some sort of new show on TNT. It looks very expensive. I forget what it's called, but it involves time travel of some point. And they've been advertising it a lot over the last few weeks. I've noticed it during Dynamite. And it looks very expensive, and I was thinking, like, I thought they got rid of all these, you know, expensive shows. Yes, it's called The Lazarus Project.
Okay, that sounds familiar. And that is a show that is actively running on TNT.
It is new.
New.
It has not debuted yet. It is an 8-hour series that is going to debut on August. It was announced last August.
Okay, so some scripted
June
programming
16th,
is still around.
June 16th. June 16th. It has an 8-episode series on June 16th.
Another point I want to make here about Collision is I can see I mean, for one thing, just to set the table a little bit, there were reports leading up to the
I'm sorry, Brandon. I was just completely wrong. The Lazarus Project aired last year and was renewed for a second season. That's coming out this year.
Okay. But being renewed. So leading up to the WBD upfront, there were reports that there was going to be a new deal, a whole new brand new deal announced between WBD and AEW. That didn't happen. There were rumors that it was going to be a $1 billion deal. Looking at it now, I think I might have said it at the time, but it makes a lot of sense from WBD's point of view. Why would you lock yourself into an additional 5 years that hasn't even started? That's not going to start for a year and a half. There's a guy with a leaf blower outside my window right now. Can you hear that? Why would you lock yourself into a 5-year deal or a 4-year deal to include a show, AEW Collision? That's, in terms of a rating, is an unknown quantity, as opposed to letting it be around for 6 months or for a year and a half and to see what kind of rating it delivers, and then you know its value.
Right. That makes sense. Just like how most TV seasons are ordered for a pilot before you commit to a longer deal.
And Tony did say, somebody asked him what he thinks AEW Collision can do for a rating. Do you recall this moment, Jesse?
Yes. He says he believes it can beat what episodes of Dynamite that have aired on preempted have aired on Thursday or on Saturdays.
He believes it can do better than the best Dynamites that have been preempted to Saturday. So I looked those up. He's referring to, I believe the last time, he's right outside my window now. The last time AEW Dynamite was preempted to a Saturday, I believe, is October 2021. So that's early in the Punk run. It's being preempted for early NHL regular season games, right? This is the infamous West Coast speculation. Oh, is the West Coast time change, whatever. Anyway, this is on Saturday. 0.28 in the demo. And a 0.22 in the demo. So the 0.28 did 727,000 viewers. The 0.22 did 575,000 viewers. Long story short, I mean, if you want to adjust for time and say, well, that was like 2 years ago going on 2 years ago, maybe adjust for cable attrition and whatnot. But in any case, I would be shocked if beyond the first month or two, AEW Collision is doing anything in the neighborhood of a 0.28, maybe even a 0.15.
Right. So that's basically what Dynamite is doing.
0.32 this past Wednesday, not going against NBA playoffs, but yeah, it's doing in the low 3.0s, the high 2.0s. Very optimistic take from Tony Khan. What do you think he can do for a rating? I've modeled it at like, and maybe I'm being conservative, but a 0.15.
Yeah. I think like when it first starts, it will do probably bigger than what it ends up doing.
And Rampage, of course, even if you leave out the Punk episode, Rampage did really well at first.
Mm-hmm. I think it can do probably somewhere between a 0.18 and a 0.20, maybe sitting right around there. I think the sincere effort has to be put in and consistently put into the idea that Collision is as important as Dynamite. You need to see significant storyline progression. You need to see, big matches given away on Collision, just like big matches are given away on Dynamite. Need to create the idea that if you want to see important stuff happening in AEW, you have to watch Collision in addition to watching Dynamite. Ultimately, Rampage was sunk by the idea that you really could skip it every week, and because everything really important happened on Dynamite. Rampage was just filler. Maybe there was like a mid-card feud that mainly took place on Rampage, but you didn't have to, the world title match program was never being really explored on Rampage after a certain point. Certainly wasn't being defended on Rampage at a certain point. You know, Chris Jericho storylines don't really take place on Rampage that much. John Moxley storylines. Yeah, sometimes he wrestles a match on Rampage, but everything you really need to see from the Blackpool Combat Club or the Elite takes place on Dynamite. MJF, never on Rampage. So you have to create consistent interest in Collision, and that's going to ultimately tell you how well it's going to do, because I think naturally a lot of fans hear Collision and they're going to think like, oh, it's another Rampage. which means that you don't have to watch it. I think that explains some of the poor ticket advances for Collision so far. But I think you have to, this is like another attempt at Rampage. Like, Rampage is a failure. Here's an attempt to do something else.
It's an attempt to wipe the slate clean and say, all right, we have to rebrand entirely and let's do it again.
And maybe Rampage is doing good for what the expectations for it are. This is an attempt to create another major show. And it has to be handled better than the way they've handled Rampage.
So David Zaslav loves wrestling. So I guess we can go through a little bit more through the press conference. By the way, if you want to submit a super chat, if you're listening or watching live on YouTube, you can hit the super chat button and we will answer your question or comment, before the end of the show. I've got some notes we can quickly go through here. This was more wrestlers, in quantity than I think I can remember on an AEW press conference. We had MJF, Chris Statlander, Orange Cassidy, Tony Storm, Bryan Danielson, all before Tony took a lot of questions. I had Tuesday Night Titans vibes as Tony brought on guest after guest here. And he just did sort of the false, okay, I'm ready for questions, and then MJF storms in, which is something that's happened before. Let's see here. MJF said that he thinks that the idea of a last match main event is dead. He called New Japan an indie fed. That's all I'm going to call out. If you have anything else there, interrupt me. Everyone applauded Chris Statlander. She took a lot of questions about her recovery. Orange Cassidy came in. Orange Cassidy was pretty funny in this situation. I don't know if you agree.
I think the wrestlers are not, like, with the exception of Bryan Danielson, who's there, who gives it much more out of character, answers and is answering bigger questions about things. The wrestlers are mostly all in character, and
Tony Storm, the media more than anybody.
And MJF. Yeah, and Orange was in character too. Orange and MJF are very entertaining. Like, it's funny, but it's not like really interesting at all. From like a
Orange Cassidy was asked at one point, "Do you think you're one of the best wrestlers in the world?" And he said, "No, not even close."
Yeah, Orange was very good, and it was kind of impressive that he could stay in character while fielding questions that he presumably did not know in advance.
Yes. The only newsworthy thing I got out of the Orange Cassidy thing is he said he would like to wrestle Zack Sabre Jr. So that maybe that's a preview of Forbidden Door.
Yeah, he kind of called out Zack Sabre Jr. which is weird because you think Bryan Danielson versus Zack Sabre Jr. would be the Forbidden Door match, since that was supposed to take place last year. The wrestlers don't really want to answer any questions out of character for the most part, with the exception of Danielson. And I got the sense the media members
talked quite a bit about her recovery.
That's true. I got the sense like the media members that want to ask questions in character were the people mainly asking questions to the wrestlers, and the more news focused reporters had more questions for Tony.
Yes. Although we did have a child who asked Tony, a question.
He asked Tony, he set up Tony to talk about the entire history of Double or Nothing.
Yes. Which we definitely needed. Bryan Danielson talked about Brian Dixon, who just passed away, the UK promoter. He talked some about his work with Tony in creative, and how they kind of have the same ideas and riff off each other's ideas. A lot of teasing. It looks like maybe we're going to get a Nigel McGuinness versus Bryan Danielson match somewhere down the road, maybe at All In. Jesse rubbing his hands together for the listening audio.
I'm so excited. I loved it when I think it was a British reporter asked about Nigel.
Yes, from what culture?
Yeah, and Danielson said, "When I look at Nigel McGuinness, I think of him, and I think it was Stephanie Chase, and he says, when I look at Nigel McGuinness now, I think I would break his neck, and I weigh 185 pounds. So,
He talked about all the books that he's reading.
He reads three books at once, Brandon. Did you know that?
Yes, he does.
It's not a good way to
read a nonfiction book, a fiction book, and poetry.
Yeah, not a good way to read books, by the way.
Okay. So then we got into the Tony Khan portion, and he was asked about all in and all out. He basically wouldn't comment on it. He was very polite, though, of course. When it comes to an all-in broadcast, he talked a little bit about this on Thursday, too. And basically what he said on Thursday was that they're still working on it. I have been softened on my view that this is going to be a show that's going to run on Max in the United States. Do you know, Jesse, of any live event, sporting or otherwise, that is aired on HBO Max?
I can't think of one.
Yeah. So unless that happens soon, I don't think that this is my tentative view. This is not going to air on Max in August. We got more talk on the collision, the length of the contract, which we talked about already. He was asked about crowd reactions by Dave. He confirmed to me that the collision deal means incremental money. He was asked about CM Punk. There was CM Punk mentioned in this press conference, and he just said, "I can't tell you that." So when he was being asked about whether CM Punk was going to be at the United Center for the first collision, and he talked about it in such a way that if it definitely was going to happen, I would think that he would not have answered in the way that he did, saying, "I can't tell you that and can't get into it." Yeah, obviously he doesn't want to, you know, give away the surprise there. The all-in show is now, according to Tony, past 65,000 tickets sold, roughly 65,000 tickets sold, well over $8 million for a gate. So Dave chimed in that it's more than, that it's greater than the record, because Tony had already brought up the, you know, the Cardiff event, which he's referring to the Clash of the Castle, which according to W's filings is $8 million for a live gate. I think Dave was calling 8.1 in any case. 8 million. He says it's well over 8 million, going on 9 million. So that would be the biggest gate in UK history. He expects Jushin Liger to be in Canada for the, Martha Hart.
Hopes Jushin Liger can come to Canada.
He joked at one point that it may be a partnership with UFC is out. He talked about his ratings expectation, which we talked about. He was asked about Goldberg and whether he's had conversations about Goldberg. He said, yes, he's had conversations about Goldberg. He didn't want to get into AEW related conversations about Goldberg. And All Access, the show that they ran after Dynamite recently, he doesn't know if it's going to be renewed, but he said lots of positive things about it and said the network was happy with it. Lots of applause for all the wrestlers too, by the way. Those are my quick notes that are relevant.
A lot of people letting the wrestlers know that they think they're great. Mm-hmm. They're very happy for them, for their success.
Yes. And I've been to other press conferences now where the applause is just, I feel like I'm kind of fixating, but the applause has been not as universal as this was, like everybody.
You included? You were clapping?
No, I didn't.
Was Dave clapping?
I had to hold on to my notebook. Me and Dave were on total opposite ends. I couldn't see him.
All right, so you're not going to reveal whether or not Dave Meltzer was clapping or not.
I couldn't see.
I thought Brian, and this is not necessarily WrestleNomics related, but I thought Brian Danielson's answer on how do you become like a good wrestler was very interesting when he talked about how Daniel Garcia and how he could maybe get over faster in the immediacy if he did cooler moves or, you know, took more risks or things like that. But the fact that he focuses a lot on the fundamentals means he'll have more longevity, in the sense that wrestling now is going to be what's working in wrestling now will be different in 10 years. And you need to have the ability to master the fundamentals and be able to pivot using those fundamentals.
Who taught him his fundamentals, by the way? Who taught him his fundamentals?
Oh, man, it's making me mad that I can't remember the other guy at Grapplers Anonymous. I don't know who was it. I believe it's probably Chris Jericho, right? He's in the Jericho.
It might have been Chris Jericho, or maybe it was the Montreal guys. Those that 3.0 tag team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh yeah, they had him too. Anyway, but when he was talking about, I thought that was really interesting. He talked about like wrestling.
While we're on that topic, real quick, let me interrupt you. Chris Jericho threw a fireball into the face of I don't know what you would call him. Backstage hand. In like an AEW polo shirt. This is Eric Kubiak, who is also a Grapplers trainee. I didn't know he was going to be there. So
A lot of screen time.
Yes.
Was Puff hiding there somewhere in the background?
I don't know. But I think Garcia and Koobs, we call him, are friends. Yeah. So I imagine he had a hand in that. I don't know.
Give him a brother payday. But back to Danielson's point, like, I found that really interesting when he talked about how, like, wrestling is going to evolve. So, like, if you're doing something that's cool right now, you really have to be able to pivot to figure out where wrestling is going so you're ready for the future of when it changes. And he also said something about, like, wrestlers who have success right away are less likely to make it in the long run because they learn habits and they get into a groove of a certain way.
What
they're
do you
not
think
ready
he meant by that. I was trying to imagine what he meant by that. Like, does he mean like, you know, freakishly muscular people who stand out right away, just for one example, but people who stand out in that kind of way, they tend not to be the people who have lasting success.
I think he meant it. That's one example. I think he meant it in a more general sense of people who are successful right away, immediately doing something, are not going to be able to pivot and reinvent themselves, I guess, and find a new way to get over if whatever they're doing immediately starts to get stale.
And I think the decision-making habits of the people who have the decision-making power in wrestling run opposite to that, right? They don't create a healthy environment for what he's saying, which I generally agree with, maybe strongly agree with.
Mm-hmm.
The decision-making people don't create an environment in which that sort of thing can be identified and be, you know, nourished.
Right. And that's why he, it's very interesting. Like, I think about, I've always thought that one of the reasons I think Chris Jericho has had a lot of longevity is because Jericho had to come up with ways to get over basically on his own. He was not pushed as a top guy immediately when he was, you know, first signed by WCW. And so he had to come up with different characters and personality traits and things to get over with the audience, kind of independent of how he was being booked. And I think that
Super Liger, he had to do Lionheart.
Well, I just think that helps you. That's one of the reasons I think he's been able to kind of reinvent himself and find new characters and catchphrases and whatever to get over, you know, over as the business continues to change. And I think he's evolved in a way that's led him to be consistently interesting in a way like someone like Randy Orton has not, because Randy Orton was pushed right away as a big star. And because he's in WWE, he's been able to essentially coast off of being presented as a big star for a long time without really having to change his character in any way, shape, or form. Now, granted, Randy Orton has a tremendous grasp of the fundamentals. So under Bryan Danielson's logic, he should be able to pivot in any way, but obviously he doesn't have to because his career hasn't worked out that way. But I thought it was really interesting when we talk about like talent evaluation and like talent development, focusing on like what it means to have longevity in this business was very interesting. And I think like Danielson himself is I would like to see him more in these pressers because he gives very interesting answers. There was no Jericho, you know, no one connected really at all to the Elite or CM Punk during this presser. You know, there's no Chris Jericho who's
it's always been winners. I would keep in mind if that's sort of a rule.
Is it?
The Elite lost almost always.
Because I feel like Jericho's on it every time, but I guess maybe not. No Jericho, no FTR, no one in the Elite, no one who, you know, Tony got asked a question about CM Punk being on Collision. He obviously didn't give a clear answer. But none of the talent were really asked about CM Punk.
Dude, like, where do you stand on the CM Punk controversy?
And like the only one you would really ask would maybe be MJF, but he was in character, so he's not going to give you a real answer. He's big on, I was going to say, MJF's big on selling the idea that he's bored, which has kind of shifted from him saying that he's going to sign with WWE, but he's giving off the idea that he has no one to beat left in AEW. So that seems to be the pivot of him teasing his jump to WWE instead of saying how much he hates AEW.
Okay. Tim B adds a super chat saying Tony Khan blew all of his big stars in two matches, thus hurting the rest of the card. Which I think there's something too. And you think about the four way, it's got four people in it. Think about the Anarchy in the Arena that had six or eight.
Eight
wrestlers in it. So, you know, I believe, according to my sources, that 4 plus 8 is 12. So that, I mean, you can nearly put on a whole wrestling show with pro wrestlers.
Yeah, and I said this. I did a preview for this show with Warren Hayes on his podcast, and I said, like, if you look at this card, look at who is just in the Anarchy in the Arena match: the Young Bucks, Brian Danielson, Kenny Omega, Hangman Page, Moxley, you know, Claudio and Yuta. You take those people, remove that match and disperse all those names throughout this card. You probably have a much more robust, interesting card. And I think there's a real argument to be said that Anarchy in the Arena could get by on perhaps less star power. But this is the major feud. I think this was the Anarchy, you know, it was the main event. It went on last, probably drew the whatever pay-per-view number they drew is probably going to be mainly attributed to interest in Anarchy in the Arena. So if they made that, Tony made that call, but I think you could definitely make an argument that the star power in that match would be better suited, spread out throughout the card. It would have probably made for a much better show.
And in hindsight, I think the crowd would have been more exhausted if that had gone before the four-way match. So just because there was so much happening there, maybe you could have timed differently if you were going to do it the other way around. In any case, okay, thank you for the super chat. And I made a note to myself that I should, you know, this is, I'm able to go here because we have subscribers. Tony Khan did not pay for my flight. My Southwest card paid for my flight and this hotel too. So I'm going to go to Forbidden Door in Toronto at the end of June. That's just a short 2-hour drive from Buffalo. And I'm planning to go to SummerSlam for Detroit for SummerSlam. So this is one way that we're reinvesting your Patreon subscription fees into content. So
I thought you were a high roller in Vegas and you were just being flown out and putting in a top suite because you're such a high roller. They know that you're going to be playing $5,000 hands in poker later.
I've not gambled any money since I've been here. There have been unending opportunities. As I posted on Twitter, this is apparently a very touristy thing to say, but I stepped off of the walkway into the terminal. The first thing you see in the terminal are slot machines. I did not expect that degree of gambling.
You didn't play those slot machines?
I did not play those slot machines.
Oh, you got to play those slot machines. Those ones are rigged to pay out at a high rate because they want you to – I'm sure they're provided by some of the casinos and you play a little bit when you step off the plane. You win early and you're like, oh, man, I got to go – let me go to one of these casinos and play. I've already won.
Right.
But the key would be just to play the one in the airport and then take your money and spend it elsewhere.
Okay, before we move on to the next topic, Chris Ely's Easy Attack says, what – was it just me, or did that AEW press conference seem very cartoonish? This seems by design. I don't think it was more cartoonish than usual.
No.
Do you think – I feel like these questions – I mean, the applause aside, I think the questions have gotten better. And there's still like – we still did have a child asking a very softball question. But compared to before – I think things have gotten better.
I mean, I think as more people go to these ones, I mean, I wasn't in the room. So like, were there a lot of people there?
I got
was
there
because
it
seemed like the same, like 5 or 6 people asked a majority of the questions.
Maybe. I mean,
especially in terms of when the wrestlers were talking, there was like a guy from like One Nation Radio, you know, Righteous Reg asked a lot of questions from the Grapsity Pod. Amy Nemedy, is that her name, from WrestleJoy? Yeah. She asked a lot of the questions. I felt like the same kind of like 5 or 6 people were asking a lot of questions about to the wrestlers. Once Tony fielded, seemed like he felt more questions.
There were more people there than I was expecting earlier in the day, because when I got to the media seating area, there weren't that many people there. And I was sort of thinking to myself, you know, it's Las Vegas and it's a little more out of the way. But by the time we all got loaded into that press room, that was a full press room. I mean, they set up chairs here and they set up, I don't know, 20 or 30 chairs, and it was pretty.
Yeah. Cool. And I didn't, I don't know, like, was Sean there?
Sean Ross Sapp?
Yeah.
No.
Cause yeah, I didn't really.
I'm being called. Do they want
You're
me to check
called
out
in your hotel room?
Carry the show.
I've got to carry the show. But to address Chris's question, more cartoonish? I don't know. I think the wrestlers, like MJF, is obviously
call,
hamming it.
Call.
MJF is obviously hamming it up, right?
They hung up
in his thing. So he's like more cartoonish. Orange Cassidy is obviously in character, so he's more cartoonish. Tony Storm was in character. So I think to that degree, I thought, you know, I don't like the applause. I'm pretty on the record about saying that. I don't like when people also preface their question by telling them how much they like them. And they call Bryan Danielson their favorite wrestler or the greatest wrestler ever. I'm sure if I watch the Celtics versus Heat post-game show tonight after Game 7, no one is going to say, Jason Tatum, you're my favorite basketball player of all time, and I'm very happy for you, and then ask him a question about the game. I don't think that's going to happen. I think in general, one thing if I'm giving advice, and this, I don't really care what your question is, but this is good advice, ask a shorter question. Because multiple times, everyone was like, what was your question?
Some people did ask two questions, which I think is, if you can get away with it, is fine if they are.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that.
Conciseness is...
The best way to, you don't need a, you're at a press conference. You don't need a preamble like before
you ask. And I think with Tony in particular, Tony will, the more words you say,
yes,
the more 100%. Chance there is for him to go on a tangent about anything that you say.
Yeah. So you really should ask Tony like a question that's under 5 words. And if you go to other press conferences, whether it's a sports press conference, whether it's a political press conference, a news press conference for whatever, and I've been to a million of them. The questions you should be asking are, you know, who, what, where, when, and why, really basic kind of stuff. If you want to ask Tony, if I was there, I'd ask Tony, like, Tony, do you have an estimate for what the pay-per-view buys were for this show? You want to ask a direct question, and it's hard. They give them more answers, but also like the talent literally was like, I'm sorry, what was the question? I don't remember what you actually asked. In a polite way, they said that, but that's just some advice, I guess.
Okay. Moving on to, we had another major premium live event from another company. WWE had a Night of Champions. And live from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. And the day before, we had a press conference in Jeddah with a lot of talent. No media, I don't think. But we did have this moment from the chief content officer of WWE, Triple H, Paul Levesque, saying his thanks.
Night of Champions proved to be the fastest selling event here in the history of us coming to Saudi Arabia. So thank you to all of you. I would also like to thank the custodian of the two holy mosques, King Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, His Royal Highness, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud. And I'd also like to thank the GEA. Without the GEA, none of this would be possible. Their championship effort allows us to be here every single time. Thank you to the GEA.
So thank you to the GEA. I forgot to thank the GEA, too, for at the top of this podcast.
And the GEA is the General Entertainment Authority in Saudi Arabia.
That's correct.
What is Triple H saying here, Brandon? What is he saying?
He's saying, wow, we really love our partners here, the General Entertainment Authority, which is an entity that's within the Saudi government. We really thank them for their $50 million that they're paying us for this with interest. And wow, we really like them. We love doing business with them, and we love being here.
He's also saying that this entertainment, this thing that you wrestling fans, whether in the audience at this press conference or watching at home, this is all brought to you by the wonderful Saudi Arabian government, the GEA, MBS, your leaders. They are responsible for bringing this thing that you love.
Championship right? effort.
I think it's really important to, I know you said this is for the ninth time we're discussing this, but it's really important because
we're talking 11 more times.
Yeah. They have, because they've been going twice a year for now almost 5 years, they have largely normalized these shows. They don't feel unusual anymore. And many people who are covering them treat them as normal. I think the two ones that stand out to me are the way Post covers it and the way Pro Wrestling Torch has covered it, which is still under the focus being that these are paid propaganda shows for the Saudi Arabian government. And I always want to remind people that the reason Saudi Arabia is paying WWE the money for this is because they want to use WWE's platform to market the Saudi Arabian government to wrestling fans, which includes you and I and anyone else who maybe is watching a WWE premium live event on Peacock. It may include anyone who goes to live shows. It may include anyone who just follows on social media. But the Saudi Arabian government is paying for you. They are paying to get your attention onto their government, onto their country. And so when you see Saudi Arabia, you think of, oh, that's the place that has those two WWE shows every year and not the place with egregious human rights violations. And it's annoying to see so many people in wrestling media cover this like it's, oh, it's just any other show now. And it's not. It's still bizarre. And it is the selling of WWE is happy to sell its audience to the Saudi Arabian government. With no qualms about it. And Triple H is happy to go to a press conference and thank the Saudi Arabian government and let everyone know that it's the Saudi Arabian government that's bringing this event to you and that you should thank them for being so generous.
John Pollock and I had a conversation with Kareem Zidan, mm-hmm. who reports on
which sports, I strongly recommend
politics. Yeah, and Kareem was really knowledgeable, and I thought was really impressive in, you know, and what he knows about this subject. So I would recommend that people listen to that. That's on the WrestleNomics feed and the Post Wrestling feed and our both of our YouTube channels, where we had, you know, a really intelligent conversation because of Kareem and John. If we look at the cage match for Double or Nothing, we better look at the cage match for Night of Champions. Night of Champions sitting at a 7.6 here. Better show according to the cage match rating than Double or Nothing. So isn't this just a case of another issue where WWE and AEW fans are running against each other? Isn't that what this is really about? Isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of blame to go around here, right? It's like, you know, if whether it's wrestling journalists giving AEW good reviews or whether it's, you know, WWE working with a government that kills journalists. I mean, there's fault on both sides here, isn't there?
No, there's not. I know you're doing a bit, but obviously the two things are very different. And whenever I tweet something about Saudi Arabia, people tell me that, well, everything's not great in America. So you can't fault WWE for going to Saudi Arabia, you know, unless you have a problem with them.
You don't see WWE doing a show or you don't see WWE, for one thing, doing a show where they're, you know, saying we would like to thank President Joe Biden for his and people chanting Biden or yes. Trump or whoever you like less. That would be the equivalent. I'm not going to make excuses for anything the American government does. But that's one of the differences, and the money is the other major difference. Then again, I mean, whether it's John Moxley bleeding every time he gets in an AEW ring, or you know, WWE accepting hundreds of millions of dollars from an authoritarian totalitarian murderous regime, I think there's in blood money, there's blood issues on both sides of this equation. I think you have to admit that at the end of the day.
I think that,
and I know you don't have an iPhone, Jesse. I know you're in the Google world, but if you have an iPhone and you're tweeting about what a problem it is for WWE to work with the Saudi government, this is another criticism that people have been saying. Like how can you be critical of the Saudi government when you're using an iPhone that is manufactured in China? And hey, look, China's got a lot of human rights violations. Look what they're doing with the Uyghurs. You can just start there for one thing.
Right. The I do think
the difference that being that I'm not being paid $50 million by the Chinese government to glorify their leadership.
Right. And that's ultimately what the problem with these shows are. If these shows were mainly just shows in Saudi Arabia, you know, they like to run in Saudi Arabia because they feel like they can draw there or whatever, like they do with all of their shows in Europe and when they go to South America occasionally and places like that. That would be one thing, but these are obviously bought and paid for shows with the idea that they are creating a positive impression of Saudi Arabia, really to encourage tourism, because that's really, this is, you know, the was it Vision 2030? That's the Saudi Arabian government.
As the economic plan.
Economic plan, which the idea being as the Saudi Arabian economy, which is largely dependent on petroleum, as that becomes, as the world theoretically becomes less dependent on petroleum, Saudi Arabia will need to find other ways to bring people to make money in its economy. And one of the ways that they're going for is tourism. So they're spending a lot of money on...
One of the takeaways, sorry, that I got from the conversation with Kareem is that this is maybe less about improving Saudi Arabia's image around the world as it is about establishing Saudi Arabia as a leader within their region, within the Middle East or within Southwest Asia, to establish them as a political and economic leader within that area of the world.
Right, and they're very competitive with, you know, very competitive is probably too nice a word, with places like Qatar and the UAE and other places that have also made large investments in entertainment. Obviously, Qatar having the World Cup late last year being probably the biggest example of that. I do think that what has helped these shows become normalized to a lot of wrestling fans is that the last several Saudi Arabia shows have been well received. After the first several shows were very poorly received. Obviously,
this better than Double or Nothing, according to Cage Match.
Right. So the idea, well, that's, if we're talking about Cage Match ratings, we have to talk about NXT Battleground.
9.12.
Yeah. The Saudi Arabia shows, I think during the first several incarnations of them, were these like almost weird events that took place in a vacuum where stars, wrestlers were coming out of retirement and having these kind of bizarre dream matches between these wrestlers who were in their 50s. And they were just kind of these strange events. And the last few shows that they've had have been more like typical WWE pay-per-view events where major stuff has happened amongst wrestlers who are active on the roster on a regular basis.
And I and think that's probably an understated part of this story. Is and, if it's and that effective. Has...
And that's normalized to these shows more, as opposed to these like bizarre monstrosities where, you know, Undertaker and Kane is wrestling, coming out of retirement, Shawn Michaels and Triple H, and these weird and matches.
Goldberg
that,
is dropping the Undertaker on his head, and
these weird matches that are almost happening in a complete vacuum, which made the shows seem more bizarre and odd than they already were. The fact that they're being treated basically the same as any event that they would be running in the United States from a storyline perspective has probably helped normalize them. And the fact that they're good, people see them
like a random sumo wrestler for the greatest Royal Rumble.
Right. That's often brought up because I guess, I don't know if it's MBS or someone else in the government.
Somebody supposedly Yokozuna. They wanted, they didn't realize. So this is the legend. Yeah.
Yes. But since Yokozuna has been dead for like 20 years, they had to just find a random other sumo wrestler and pretend that he was a Yokozuna-like character. I forget his name.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess, I posted a few things on Twitter and there were about the show, including the comparison that this relationship has now reached with this show because it's $50 million. And people don't know that this is the number. $50 million. Per show, not per year, per show. 50 plus 50, according to my sources, is $100 million per year. And pandemic notwithstanding, they do two shows a year. So $100 million. That's, in a year like this one, about 7% of WWE's entire business. Okay, earlier years where they were making a little bit less total revenue, it's even higher. It's as much as 10% when this relationship started. So it's a huge portion of their total revenue. If you compare it to every WrestleMania ticket ever sold in today's dollars, it's well above that. It's about $300 million. Every WrestleMania ticket ever sold, going back to Hulk Hogan, Paul Orndorff, Roddy Piper, and Bob Orton, and Mr. T, and all that. 1985, 39 years, it's about $300 million. This is at $450 million within 5 years. It will be $1 billion when this is all said and done. So I think we're going to end up at multiples of whatever the WrestleMania total would be at that time, for some frame of reference.
The Saudi Arabia deal as a reference point is much closer to like their deals with the TV deals or Peacock than it is with like a very successful gate like WrestleMania.
Right. The difference, I guess, to me and to probably to the lay fan is like that this is it's just apparently an event, though. There's no distribution that's happening, right, as part of this. It's not like
– No, it's selling – it's to sell the Saudi Arabia government to the wrestling fans. It's advertising. There's like – I was reading a book. It's called I want to make sure I get the title right. I'm going to get it wrong. That's going to make me mad. Oh, okay. So it's called The Club. It's by Joshua Robinson and Jonathan Clegg. And it's about the history of the English Premier League. And it talks about how the UAE, the Emirates government, purchased Manchester City and pumped a bunch of money into Manchester City to make it, you know, the most dominant club in England, which succeeded in doing.
This is not Man United, which might be bought by the Qataris.
No, that's a – well, the Qataris also own a French club and have done basically the same model as Manchester City. But basically they bought Manchester City, which was a kind of a traditional yo-yo club where they would be up in the top division, then they'd be down in the second division. We're not considered a particularly historically prestigious club. But basically they spent a bunch of money using, you know, funds from the government, which are largely funds derived from petroleum, to make the club seem really successful. And they spent all this money, and it was, I forget what the figure was, but it was, you know, a couple billion dollars in total, from the purchase to the construction of a new stadium to the signing of all these star players and things like that. And it got into why they were doing this. And it was so to create the idea that the Emirates government is associated with this championship soccer team that is in this global sport that people around the world will see. And it talked about that investment figure. But then it also mentioned that the investment that they spent on the soccer team pales in comparison to the investment made with the Fly Emirates airline, which, you know, is a lucrative worldwide like kind of luxury airline company, and that they spent billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars on that, far more money than they spent on Manchester City. But the whole idea was to take the Emirates name, slap it on all these fancy planes, have them fly all over the world. And so people that are flying first class somewhere are seeing, man, the Emirates, they know how to build an airplane. Look at me. I've got, a service coming right to my seat. I've got, a huge chair. I can lay down. I can watch all this stuff on television while I'm flying. It's flying in the best experience possible. And it all goes to show like how much money these governments are willing to spend to change their public image, which largely to most people is seen as this backwards place that is far behind human rights evolutions. And so the money that they're spending on WWE, and this is Saudi Arabia, this isn't the Emirates, but the game plan is the exact same. The money that they're spending is the $50 million is nothing to them, because we're talking about, an investment fund that has kind of unlimited resources. It has the wealth of an entire nation backing it. And to a degree, it almost can't be calculated. So they're willing to spend so much money, and it's such a and WWE is morally, has no problems taking that money. WWE is one of the only kind of, there are other companies that have done things in Saudi Arabia. There's certainly other soccer players and leagues that have taken money to go to Saudi Arabia and Europe. But, you know, we talked about like Endeavor, Ari Emanuel return a huge investment from the Saudi government following the murder of Jamal Khashoggi?
Yes.
But WWE's been the company that's willing to take that money and look the other way.
And I'm just looking here. What is the market cap of, let's say, Saudi Aramco? It would be one of the biggest businesses in the world. $2 trillion when I convert it from Saudi riyals to U.S. dollars. $2 trillion. So that, to, for some context, one of the biggest businesses in the world, I believe, are Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon, which are in the trillion range.
Yeah, so we're talking about, like, it's like when we talk about the streamers, we talk about like, okay, NBCU has this amount of money, you know, Paramount Plus has this amount of money. And then there's, you know, Apple and Amazon, which kind of have like unlimited money in a way to spend on rights if they wanted to.
Apple is now $2.76 trillion in market cap.
Yeah. And the Saudi Arabian government is kind of like that, in the sense that they have so much money that
Amazon,
they can spend
$1.23 trillion.
Right. Because there's no way that this investment is worth it. Like there's no way that this is a value investment, which is, oh yeah, it's worth paying WWE $50 million per show for them to have a wrestling event.
Paul Levesque did say this was the fastest selling ticket event in the history of this relationship.
Yeah.
I imagine the Saudi government is collecting that ticket money, but you know, we're probably talking tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars on $50 million.
What a job Paul Levesque has, right? He's in charge of creative, kind of. He's working under Vince again. Vince is great. Vince doesn't have to go and do a speech in support of the autocratic Saudi government. That's Paul's job now, damn it.
He never did, in fact.
What?
Vince's hands are clean. He never did one of these speeches.
Yeah. So Paul Levesque, he's
Microsoft is too
pretend, he's pretending to still be the head man in charge of creative. Did not follow his wife out the door of the company, and now gets to go to Saudi Arabia and lead a MBS chant in front of a bunch of people.
I do believe that Paul Levesque has probably never had more influence in main roster creative than he has now. But Vince is
heavily
involved, I think.
Well, he probably had more influence before Vince's formal return to the company.
Okay, true. Yes, I would agree with that. Yeah. Before July 2022. Yes.
Yes, yes. No, I would agree.
For the interregnum.
Yeah.
Yes, in between. Okay. But I was saying, I posted that image comparing the WrestleMania ticket sales, and I posted just the video, in fact, of the video that we just, the clip that we just played of Triple H thanking MBS, thanking King Solomon, thanking the GEA, very, very strong reactions were elicited, including people who thought the video was fake, but it's that you can find it on WWE's own official YouTube channel. But you know, some people did bring up an interesting point, which was, you know, if you think about it, whether it's journalists who are posting tweets using their iPhones, we've pointed out the problem with the iPhones, or the Saudi government imprisoning citizens for their tweets, you can see that there's concerning problems on both sides when it comes to Twitter. Or, you know, let's talk about the outrage here too. Whether it's reporters who are pointing out the lucrative relationship between WWE and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, or certain fans hurling criticisms and insults at reporters for doing so, I think both sides, at the end of the day, are guilty of selective outrage. Would you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't.
But it's in the middle every time. The truth.
Well, the truth is
right in the middle.
The truth is, most wrestling fans don't care at all about the Saudi Arabia deal.
They're just not. I don't know if it's even like apathy.
It's not relevant to them.
It's way above their awareness or their inquisitiveness.
There's no curiosity or interest in it. There's much more interest in like storylines and things like that. And that's across wrestling in general. Like if you want to go back to the press conference, like people ask questions at the AEW press conferences that are kind of kayfabe related or storyline related, because that's what they're interested in. And that's what their readers or their fans or their listeners to their podcast are interested in. They're interested in the exploration of kayfabe details. They're not interested in, you know, the larger real story behind the entertainment that they watched. There are people that's what their focus is on, and that's why they ask those questions. And I think
why
for
do you
a
think
lot of
that
people,
is that just a sad commentary on human nature, or is that something in particular about wrestling fans?
I don't think it's something in particular about wrestling fans. I think it's true for all entertainment. I think most people, I think a lot of people watching, let's say they're watching let's talk about the Flash, the upcoming Flash movie that's coming out, right? There's a lot of controversy surrounding Ezra Miller, the star of The Flash. I'll be honest, I'm not 100% sure what the accusations are against him. I don't want to say what they aren't, but I believe they're pretty serious accusations of some form of sexual misconduct, I believe. And there's a lot of people who are like, I'm not going to watch The Flash. I'm not going to support Ezra Miller and you know the company that's going forward with presenting him as a star of this movie. But that's probably a very small percentage of potential moviegoers. I think most moviegoers are going to make a decision based on whether or not they want to see the movie, based on how the trailer looks, what the other stars in the movie are like, things like that. I think most people are not going to be looking at from a moral perspective of should I support this thing or not. And that's just one example. I think with, you know, any other form of entertainment, most people, the vast majority of the fans of whatever it is, it could be a musical artist, it could be a movie, it could be a sports team, are not looking at like the morals of the individuals involved. They're more just invested in the entertainment value they derive from it. And it's not connected to anything else. I think that's a small but perhaps vocal aspect of both the media and fandom. It should be higher for the media, but that's I guess a different conversation, right?
So that's number 9 out of 11. 11 more to go, 20 total, events for the Saudi government.
And it will be very interesting to see what happens with that renewal. I think it would be like if the Saudi Arabian government was interested in it before, it would be a slam dunk. But the fact that Ari Emanuel has expressed real hesitancy of making a deal with the Saudi Arabian government, it would be bad from a financial perspective to give that up. But perhaps, and again, Endeavor has a deal with the UAE, right, for Fight Island and shows like that. Yes. So perhaps WWE could sell themselves to another Middle Eastern country that's looking to do the same thing.
Yes. Okay, so we'll be talking about this 11 more times. If you don't like us, you can criticize us for it. Just don't criticize MBS, because you might get killed. So we'll move on to, I guess before we move on to another subject, we will acknowledge Super Chat from Bebe, who says, new to the channel, nice to hear real talk for a change. Thanks. Appreciate that.
Like I said, I think the only two places that I've seen that I think have covered this, the most recent WWE show, honestly, are Pure WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling and Wade Keller over at The Torch.
So we'll briefly touch on a little bit of newsworthy information that came from Nick Khan, the WWE CEO, at the JP Morgan TMT conference on Tuesday. He said that WWE is still in the exclusive negotiating window for Raw with NBC Universal, but that the exclusive window has ended with Fox for SmackDown. So this is a little bit contrary to what I've believed in the past, you know, based on things that Nick Khan had said at the earnings call most recently. But so SmackDown, they're out of the window. They're out of the window for SmackDown, but they're still in the window for Raw with NBC Universal. He basically said that, you know, we did 3.6x for an increase on TV rights fees in 2018 for the deal that they're currently under, and basically said it's not going to be as great as that deal, but it's still going to be, we're still expecting something great, he said. He said, and feel free to interrupt me because I'm just going to run through this. He said, though, it's hard to imagine, this is me talking. He said, we followed the NBA playbook 5 years ago in wanting to not have just one exclusive partner for Raw and SmackDown, and to split them two ways, because remember, Raw and SmackDown were both on the USA Network at that time. And now we're looking at the marketplace in its totality and thinking there might be more options than even that. So is he talking about three different homes for Raw and SmackDown? That's hard to imagine. Yet, I don't know. I spent a little bit of time thinking about this and thought, I don't know. You know, if Fox doesn't keep SmackDown, who are the players? Amazon. He talked up Amazon again on this conference, as he did at the Moffitt Nathanson conference in the prior week. So Amazon, he's clearly trying to woo. NBCU, it's realistic to think about NBCU taking back SmackDown. Is there a world in which maybe there's some sort of partnership or deal where Amazon gets some of the rights for a show, and a traditional network gets another form of the rights for a show? I don't know. He said things to the effect of, you know, we don't see us dealing and splitting out digital rights, though. So I don't know how you get to three partners here, unless we're talking about NXT, but I don't think NXT has that value.
Well, he also mentioned in this, I think it was the same JP Morgan discussion, where he mentions that he reiterates NXT could be a third brand. Doesn't have to be developmental. It could be, you know, a third brand. So it looks like they might be, they want to obviously want to sell the idea that NXT could be just as important as Raw and SmackDown, and that people should also be interested in NXT. So if that's the idea, then you could say Raw could be somewhere, SmackDown could be somewhere, NXT could be somewhere else.
He also said that NXT ratings are up 20% year over year, which is inaccurate. It's up. It's down a little bit in total viewership, but it is up in 18 to 49. It's up about 5% year over year in 18 to 49. By the way that I slice it, by looking at the quarters.
Is it up in any metric 20% over year?
Like
particular demo,
and maybe
or
in some
like
demo it might be.
Well, I'm wondering why he said that, because
Raw and SmackDown are up 20% in the demo,
right? But NXT, It's not.
I don't think so. Like, maybe in 1834, but I don't have it in front of me.
I think it's, you know, he said that about NXT. I think splitting Raw and SmackDown, like Raw being some weeks on like one network and some weeks on other. I mean, he also mentioned things like, could Raw be run head to head with Monday Night Football on NBC if they wanted to do that?
Let me read the quote here. It says, Raw is 3 hours. We don't anticipate that changing. But there's internal conversations on the 10 to 11 hour to make it a little more adult themed. It's something we're discussing internally. He also added that we're still open to a third hour for SmackDown. So if you heard the news about AEW Collision being 2 hours of additional weekly wrestling content, you figure that's great and that's not enough. Third hour SmackDown is on the table. Fox, as it's currently constituted, he said, is a 2 hour prime time. So Fox, as people may know, only has prime time window from 8 to 10. It's not like the other networks that have 8 to 11. So that's the deal that Fox wanted to do 4 or 5 years ago. So if it goes somewhere other than Fox, no reason why it couldn't be 3 hours or 8 hours or whatever.
And there's a, it's kind of interesting. I'm trying to think of like a way, like NASCAR has an interesting contract where, if I have it correctly, it's NBC and Fox both have contracts with NASCAR. And for the first half of the year, they're on one network. And the second half of the year, they're on another network. And they rotate back and forth each year. So 1 year, NBC will have the first half of the schedule and Fox will have the second half.
Okay.
And the other year, you know, Fox will have the first half of the schedule.
That's probably a more realistic way to think about it than what I was saying earlier. Yeah.
Right. So like they could do something. With NASCAR, it's like 1 year you get the Daytona 500, which is obviously the biggest race of the year. And then the other partner gets the playoffs, you know, the chase for the cup.
And isn't March Madness something like that too, where I know CBS and TNT and Turner, WBD, they have rights, but they alternate what they have. And certainly the Super Bowl alternates year to year.
I'm not sure. I feel like CBS always has the championship game and things like that. The Super Bowl does alternate between the four or the three network partners, right?
Something alternates. Maybe it's the NBA final. I don't know.
NBA finals are always on ABC. But yeah, the Super Bowl does. The Super Bowl, you know, 1 year will be on Fox, next year NBC, the year after that ESPN/ABC, and then I think it goes back to Fox and NBC or CBS. So that could happen. I mean, I think everything Nick Khan has said the last few weeks that we've kind of discussed here all stems back to the idea of he wants to create the idea that WWE is flexible. WWE is willing to do kind of anything that any prospective broadcast partners want them to do. You want the shows to be longer, they can be longer. If you want them to be shorter, they can be shorter. You want NXT to be a third brand with main roster stars, we could do that. We could put more stars on NXT. If your buyer wanted that, we could. You don't want Raw, you want Raw, but you don't have space on Monday night, Raw could be on Tuesday night. We're not married to that idea. So everything he says is selling the idea that WWE is willing to work with whatever any prospective streaming partner or network partner wants them to do, which is smart. That's what you should do when you're selling a product, is sell the idea that you're flexible. Is Vince McMahon really that flexible? Would they seriously entertain the idea of Raw moving off of Monday night? Would it be even a good idea to move Raw off Monday night? I'm not sure, but it seems like that's kind of everything he says. You know, the 10-11 hour could be more mature. It could be a different rating. If that's what the broadcast partner would want, then I'm sure they would accommodate that. But I take this all as, you know, he's trying to give off the idea that WWE is willing to work with whatever any prospective buyer wants them to do, which obviously is trying
to. I think when it comes to things like, could Raw really move off of Monday? Well, if you pay them, there's a premium to make that happen, I think. That's where you get
right for the right business partner, they'll do anything. Right. What do you think of like a more mature WWE product even looks like? Like a TV-14?
We're talking adult themed.
Yeah. What does that even mean?
Blood, maybe, in certain situations.
Blood for sure. I think blood for sure. Blood's like
under Vince, it gets very hazardous, I think. Blood and swearing.
Yeah, I think honestly, this is going to sound crazy because of what the general narrative is that PG is ruined WWE or whatever. I think going to a more mature theme would be a hindrance to WWE. Outside of blood and, you know, maybe swearing, but I think they would be I think it would be a bad thing for WWE. I think they'd be focused on more gross-out humor. I think there'd be a lot more like sex storylines. I think it would probably not be a positive for women performers. I think there'd be a lot more poorly done, poor taste storylines really, and characters.
What is Mattel's stomach really for things like that? And what is the reaction from advertisers? And it's just something that we always hear alluded to or theorized, and we just don't know firsthand, and I don't have a great grasp. Like, but the notion is always that, well, they can't do blood and violence and things like this because they do action figures through Mattel, and that's a really valuable partnership. And you want to have kids to be able to, you know, parents buy action figures for their kids, so you got to have a PG product. How important is that? I don't know. But it's certainly, to some degree, it is.
But I just think from a quality standpoint, I don't think Vince McMahon's vision of a more mature-themed wrestling show is going to be better than what it is now. I think in a lot of ways, being hamstrung by not being able to do as much as maybe they have been able to do in the past, the product is a little bit better. It's certainly more respectful to women than it was 15 or 20 years ago. Maybe that's just an inherent sign of our culture, but I would be very concerned if I would be concerned about what a more mature themed WWE product is.
On UK rights, UK fans alert. UK media partner Sky was disappointed. He said with the lack of televised events in the UK, and that's something that they're addressing in with Clash at the Castle, Money in the Bank in London. Yeah, they've been doing Raw and SmackDown at the O2 for all those years, but in terms of really big events, obviously they hadn't done a big pay-per-view there since SummerSlam 1992. He seemed to be pushing the idea that Sky is going to be a bidder along with current partner BT Sport for the next round. So that the UK deal, I believe, will expire like 3 months after the US deal. So that would be at the very end of 2024, which will be the next priority along with the India deal after they're done with US deals. On recruiting, my ears went up when he said this, that the, you know, under the previous recruiting strategy, he said, quote, it was mining the independent wrestling territories to find the next great WWE superstar so soon that we mined a lot of that. And yes, there will be stars that continue to come out of there. He went on to talk about the great NIL program. A little bit of a moderation in Nick Khan's tone here on recruiting, where to my maybe sensitive ears on this subject, he's been more dismissive of independent wrestling and whether that's a real source for talent. That being said, I would really agree that independent wrestling has been mined, not just by WWE, but by AEW. And I almost had like a flash of thought watching the pay-per-view in the building last night during that Anarchy in the Arena match and thinking about, you know, almost all these wrestlers, I guess with the exception of Moxley and Cesaro, Claudio were on the independents not that many years ago, or at least you could book them, you know, Ring of Honor could book them, let's say. And now they're all, that being a symbol of what's happened, the independent wrestling has really been mined. And I think, I don't want to get into a long discussion about the US Indies, but I think that's what's happened. It's not like something inherently wrong with the independent wrestling scene as much as it's been harvested. And I don't know if it's ever going to get better, but, or if this is just sort of the appropriate valuation and evaluation of that talent.
On the NXT Battleground show.
Did you watch it?
All right.
And enjoy it.
Let me do a quick count here, but I wanted to ask you, like, I'm looking at this card because we talked about, you know, NXT. NXT is obviously they pivoted very strong a couple of years ago. They got rid of a lot of like the independent wrestlers or whatever and focused a lot more on WWE homegrown talents. And whether it's people who they're signing off NIL deals or they're just college athletes that they've recruited after their, you know, college playing days were over. And the show NXT, the television show, it often has a lot of like green inexperienced wrestlers on it with the idea that it's being a true developmental show. But I'm looking at this Battleground card, and let me ask you this, Brandon. How many of these wrestlers on Battleground? It appears, looks like there's about 15 wrestlers on the show in total in matches. How many of those wrestlers do you think were WWE trained wrestlers?
What do you mean by that?
Wrestlers who were.
This is a problematic categorization, as I've discovered.
That were trained and developed by WWE and did not have substantial independent wrestling experience.
If I'm writing the filings, all of them are ours. We trained all of them in the Performance Center. You're welcome. What I'm saying is I've done research projects like this in the past, and it gets really hard to draw an objective line. We all know what we're trying to talk about. I'm not trying to say that what you're talking about isn't meaningful. It is, but it's really hard to draw that line because there's a gradient, and it's harder to draw it black and white.
Right.
I want to say, did you have X number of matches that we can find in cage matches? Not a complete record. Mm-hmm. You know, but we have to lean on things like that.
All right. Well, how many of the 15 wrestlers do you think are people that were signed without substantial independent wrestling experience?
Substantial. Half of them.
So it's 4 out of 15.
Who had or didn't have?
Have 4 out of the 15 wrestlers were trained by WWE, basically.
Okay.
So then this is, again, the new NXT, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it's shifting or not because I'm looking at this card. So I'd say the Creed brothers are trained by WWE for sure. Tiffany Stratton, trained by WWE for sure. And Bron Breakker, trained from WWE for sure. The rest of the names on the card, all to me had very substantial pre WWE experience. You know, Wesley, Joe Gacy, Tyler Bate, those guys were all in the independents for years. Noam Dar, Dragon Lee, obviously from Mexico, Ilya Dragunov and Dijak, both, you know, substantial years on the independents. Gallus, obviously, are veterans from the UK. Lyra Valkyra was a wrestler on Ireland for a number of years before getting signed by WWE. And Carmelo Hayes obviously had a few years on the New England Independent. So it's not even that to me. Those are pretty clear cut, not trainee people.
You know, I was thinking during the press conference last night too, that the class of the uncharted territory talent, we've got MJF, Orange Cassidy, Chris Statlander, Carmelo Hayes, Brandon Thurston, all have gone on to do great things. What can you say?
Well, before you include yourself, I was going to say they were all working with a very good veterans that could teach them the solid fundamentals that they would need.
I don't think I worked with any of those people, but they're very, you know, they're very talented. Yeah.
Well, you know, you're in the back, you're in the locker room or whatever. I mean, well, it goes to show, you know, where the indies were, and especially where, you know, beyond wrestling was with, in the Northeast in general, with finding talent. Obviously, I think the Create a Pro early class has gone on to be very successful as far as, you know, training talents. A lot of it is some people are going to be generationally talented, like MJF is. But I don't know. I was looking at that. I thought it was kind of interesting. It felt more like and obviously it's gotten great reviews, the Battleground show so far, but it feels like you look at that, right? It feels more like the earlier NXT takeover events, which were obviously stuffed with, you know, veteran indie wrestlers going out and having their best matches possible. And this one seems closer to that.
Okay. I'm showing the AEW pay-per-views I wanted to show. Yeah. NXT Battleground is sitting at over a nine rating. And it will probably get a little bit lower, but it'll.
Ilya Dragunov and Dijak was the highest rated match on cage match history for a period of time last night. It has since fallen down to a 9.43 after 155 votes. I'll have to watch it for sure.
Okay.
But yeah, to get back to that, I brought that up just because I think it goes into Nick Khan. I wonder if they're going to make a sincere attempt at making NXT seem like more of a viable third brand if they believe that it is more valuable that way to market it. When its rights fees get negotiated, you've been pretty bearish on NXT's value on USA at the moment. Could they turn that into something? We know that their viewership really did not fare very well when they did the hard reset to NXT 2.0 and changed everything. And, you know, obviously lost a lot of their key wrestlers like Adam Cole and Johnny Gargano and Keith Lee and these people. But is there some way to get that back to make NXT a more viable television entity week to week, as opposed to just this bizarre, you know, developmental thing where people are testing out wacky gimmicks?
I'm not optimistic. We do have a super chat from Delmar who asks, shouldn't Raw's total viewers be improving with the surge of 18 to 49 when Monday Night Football starts and takes a bite out of 1849, we're looking at 1.4s. I guess we're talking about 1.4 million. 1849 is up more strongly than total viewership. I don't think that like P50 plus is way down though. His total viewership is up for both Raw and SmackDown as well.
I
post every week with the chart and the year of year differences by quarter at the bottom.
And 18 to 49 is what they lost in a tremendous amount in the previous few years. So it makes sense that if the product improves or people get more into the WWE, the people that are coming back are going to be disproportionately people in 18 to 49, if that's what the people that they were turning off at a higher rate.
34 is up even more.
Yes, the new characters are reaching new people. I don't know if it's, you know, it's Cody, it's Sami Zayn, it's the Bloodline stuff. Dominic Mysterio, whatever's happened, you know, whatever you want to attribute it to, it's obviously reaching a new audience, a younger audience. Maybe it's, you know, Logan Paul and Bad Bunny bring in more attention to the product. I wouldn't rule that out, but you'd have to look at, they're doing something to appeal to a younger demographic. Maybe it was just a period of time where Vince McMahon wasn't fully in charge and someone a little bit closer to their demographic and Triple H was running the show.
So just to quantify it, 18 to 49 for Raw and SmackDown, both up 20%. Raw's up 22%, SmackDown up 20%. And if we look at the younger half of the demo, 30%. Raw is up 30% on this quarter. NXT is up 55%. So there you go. Maybe that's, Jesus, 55%. And again, this is the younger half of the demo, 18 to 34 in Q2.
Right. And if you look at the bottom of those columns, which we go back a few years to see what they were losing, it's almost proportional to what they've been gaining.
And then some of this is in the prime of the pandemic here is what we're, where we see these 50% losses. This is in, you know, late 2020, early 2021.
Yeah, and that's also probably a cause, you know, the whether certainly pre-Thunderdome. But even during the Thunderdome, it was a tough watch, and a lot of people just had no interest in watching wrestling when there was no crowd to make noise. And maybe it took a little bit of time for those people to come back. Maybe it took a storyline gaining some traction or a new wrestler debuting in the company to bring some of those people back. But that's also probably a factor that people tuned it out during the pandemic and are kind of slowly made their way back as they've gained interest. And yeah. Whether the audience noise is organic or not, the atmosphere for WWE shows is way better than it was even pre-pandemic. Like, I don't think people realize, like, if you go back like 2019, 2018, the absolute apathy that the audience had for a lot of wrestlers and the kind of lack of truly organically over specifically baby faces in the company.
Yeah, should now rewatch the project, rewashing the pandemic era.
I mean, the pandemic, I have no interest. But if you go back and watch, like, now you go to a WWE show and the audience feels, if you watch a WWE show, the audience feels way more into a lot of the people on the card. They're not just popping for one name. They're more into a variety of wrestlers. And there's probably a number of reasons for that. But the atmosphere is a lot better, which I think helps, obviously, sell the product.
Okay. I think that's all I have. I think we've done all the super chats. You want to? You got like a minute to get one in right now if you want. I think that's it. You got anything to add, Jesse? Anything to plug? Any other topics you want to bring up here?
We didn't go over the United Center ticket sales.
United Center ticket sales. I think I have the WrestleTix spreadsheet out here. United Center is on June 17th Chicago, Illinois. And the latest WrestleTix number, I don't know if he's posted this. I apologize if I'm jumping ahead here. 6,526 is the latest count in the spreadsheet from WrestleTix. 6,526 what did they put in here for the first dance? 14,000 or so? Mm-hmm.
Was there so that's the attendance. And those they announced the United Center on Wednesday. And then tickets, you know, pre-sale started pretty obviously soon after that. It was only a few days ago. Was there any CM Punk vibes at Double or Nothing last night? Was the crowd chanting for us? There were some negative CM Punk signs I could make out in the audience, but was there
I saw some people around in CM Punk merch, but there were no other CM Punk vibes.
Yes. Interesting. Yeah, I know. Cause like I'm really curious to know more about like the audience. Cause I don't know if it could have been a crowd miking issue.
The crowd wasn't that hot for the middle part of the show. They were hot for the last two matches. Yeah. They were hot for the Battle Royal. They were hot for the biggest moments mm-hmm. in the middle of the show, but really not that hot for everything in between. I think what you heard on the telecast is basically what was happening.
Do you think there were too many gimmick matches on this show?
I think there was not enough emotional investment in enough of the card. And maybe there's something to Tim B's point about putting a lot of wrestlers in a few matches, especially the key matches at the end, that spread the talents that people care about a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, your best wrestlers. Really, for sure. Like, if you look at who have had the best matches in AEW history, it's a very disproportionate number of people that were in that Anarchy in the Arena match.
Wheeler Utah, another Uncharted Territory alumni.
Yeah. Was the Anarchy in the Arena match difficult at all to watch live?
There were people popping for stuff, and I was like, what are they popping for? I mean, they saw what was happening. I was like, mm-hmm. I didn't know what was happening at times. Mm-hmm. I was it back sounds like kind of, with media during that time.
It does sound like a unique experience to see live. Did you get that vibe? Like, it's different.
There's
than
like two to three things happening at once throughout this arena. Yeah. On one hand, you can look wherever you want. So it's a different experience versus what's happening on TV, where you have to watch whatever they're showing you, I guess. But just mm-hmm. a lot of moments where suddenly there was a pop. So enough people to make a pop happen that I just didn't know what they were popping for. I was seated back down where the media section was. So this is in mm-hmm. like the 100s, directly opposite the entrance way. So I probably didn't have the greatest vantage point as opposed to people who are up on high.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because we've talked about this before, the idea of like, having a signature match that you can take place.
You could
once
see stuff
year.
On the screen too for wherever yeah. we're seated, by the way.
What we talked about, like having a signature match that could take place in the pay-per-view every year that fans would be invested in seeing because the reputation of that match type is very high, similar to the Royal Rumble or Money in the Bank. And could Anarchy in the Arena being an annual thing, a Double or Nothing?
I'll tell you what, it's cost effective. You don't have to set up a giant structure that costs $100,000 or whatever to set up every time.
Mm-hmm. And they have, could this be a consistent selling point for the pay-per-view, irregardless of star power in the match necessarily? Like,
not irregardless, could you have, but I think it started to develop a valuable brand, if you will.
Right. And that, I think, in the long term is very good. If there's, we've had two of these matches. They both seem to have been very well received. Next year, could you have an Anarchy in the Arena that maybe has a little less star power in it? And that star power is in a better other positions in the card. But people are into Anarchy in the Arena pretty much as they are this year. Because Anarchy in the Arena, the match type, is the star of the show. And not necessarily, because John Moxley and Kenny Omega are in it.
Maybe.
I had one more question about the show. But I seem to have lost my train of thought thinking about Anarchy.
While you're thinking of that, I have to get a ride to the airport soon. So I will, I guess usually I would have the audio up by 6 anyway. So I have a long layover on the way home today. I'll probably get the audio version of this podcast.
No flight direct to Vegas.
I live in Buffalo, New York, and not exactly an airport hub.
Yeah, but I feel like Vegas has so many flights to and from. So where's your layover, O'Hare?
In Chicago. But I did fly from Chicago to Las Vegas. I was on alert to see if Phil Brooks was on my flight, and I don't believe he was. So, there is like one direct flight from Buffalo to Las Vegas, but it was like really expensive, or I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't get it.
All right. No, well then I'll let you, we'll sign off then, I guess. We don't want to have you miss your flight.
We're okay. Cause my ride isn't for like another 45 minutes.
Okay.
I've so tightly timed this whole trip. Actually I had a lot of time yesterday to just wander around.
You were living it up on the strip.
I was spending a lot of money on expensive, not great food, but expensive food. I spent like $30 on coffee and breakfast this morning.
Did you have any, did you meet anyone in the industry while you were in Vegas?
I met some people from Wrestling Inc. I met people I've met before. I saw Dominic D'Angelo again. I met Steve Fall for the first time. We had a nice conversation for a while.
My good friend, Steve Fall.
Your friend, Steve Fall.
His thick North Shore accent.
I saw Denise Salcedo again. Probably other people I'm leaving out. Yeah, it was a nice time.
All right. Or we'll be back at the normal time on next. I will not be here next Sunday.
Okay. Are you renegotiating the contract?
I will be in Rhode Island.
Okay. Alrighty. We'll talk to you next week, Sunday at 11 a.m. at the normal time for WrestleHonks Radio. We appreciate everybody listening and supporting and super chatting and subscribing and helping make these weekends possible. I hope it's adding some value for you. And so I get to get in there and ask a question and stuff like that and hopefully give you a little bit better coverage and vantage point of what happened on the weekend. So appreciate it. Talk to you next time.